Talking to him was another matter. Then there was Zoe. How was she going to feel about her Long Island frolic being interrupted? And not going to Nahant, to her grandparents' place? That worried me at first. Yet I somehow did not think she would mind. She'd never been to Italy. And I could let her into the secret. I could tell her the truth. Tell her we were going to meet Sarah Starzinski's son. And then there were my parents. What could I tell them? Where would I begin? They, too, were expecting me at Nahant after the Long Island stay. What on earth was I going to tell them?
"Yeah," drawled Sharla later on when I explained all this. "Yeah, sure, running off to Tuscany with Zoe, finding this guy, and just saying sorry 60 years later."
I flinched at the irony in her voice.
"Well, why the hell not?" I asked.
She sighed. We were sitting in the large front room she used as an office on the second floor of her house. Her husband was turning up later on that evening. Dinner was waiting in the kitchen. We had made it together earlier. Sharla craved bright colors, as did Zoe. This room was a melting pot of pistachio green, ruby red, and luminous orange. The first time I had seen it, my head had started to throb, but I had gotten used to it, and I secretly found it intensely exotic. I always tended to go for neutral, bland colors like brown, beige, white, or gray, even in my dress code. Sharla and Zoe preferred to overdose on anything bright, but they both carried it off beautifully. I both envied and admired their audacity.
"Stop being the bossy older sister. You're pregnant, don't forget. I'm not sure all this traveling is the right thing to do at the moment."
I said nothing. She had a point. She got up and went to put an old Carly Simon record on. "You're So Vain," with Mick Jagger whining in the backup vocals. Then she turned around and glared at me.
"Do you really have to find this man right now, this very minute? I mean, can it wait?"
Again, she had a point. I looked back at her. "Sharla, it's not that simple. And no, it can't wait. No, I can't explain. It's too important. It's the most important thing in my life right now, apart from the baby." She sighed again.
"That Carly Simon song always reminds me of your husband. You're so vain, I bet you think the song is about you."
I let out an ironic chuckle.
"What are you going to tell Mom and Dad?"
she asked.
"About not coming to Nahant, and about the baby?"
"God knows."
"Think it over, then. Think it over carefully."
"I am. I have." She came up behind me and rubbed my shoulders.
"Does that mean you've got it all organized? Already?"
"Yep."
"You fast one."
Her hands felt good on my shoulders, making me drowsy and warm. I looked around at Sharla's colorful workroom, the desk covered with files and books, the light ruby curtains moving in the gentle breeze. The house was quiet without Sharla's kids.
"And where does this guy live?"
she asked. "He has a name, William Rainsford. He lives in Lucca."
"Where's that?"
"Small town between Florence and Pisa."
"What does he do for a living?"
I looked him up on the internet, but his stepmother told me anyway. He's a food critic. His wife is a sculptor. They have two kids.
"And how old is William Rainsford?"
"You sound like a cop. Born in 1959.
"And you're just going to waltz into his life and set all hell loose?"
I pushed her hands away, exasperated.
"Of course not. I just want him to know our side of the story. I want to make sure he knows nobody has forgotten what happened."
A wry grin.
"He probably hasn't either. His mom carried that with her all her life. Maybe he doesn't want to be reminded."
A door banged downstairs.
"Anyone home? The beautiful lady and her sister from Paris?"
The thud of steps coming up the stairs.
Barry, my brother-in-law. Charla's face lit up. So much in love, I thought. I felt happy for her. After a painful, trying divorce, she was truly happy again. As I watched them kiss, I thought of Bertrand. What was going to happen to my marriage? Which way would it turn? Would it ever work out? I pushed it all away from my mind as I followed Charla and Barry downstairs. Later on, in bed, Charla's words about William Rainsford came back to me.
Maybe he doesn't want to be reminded.
I tossed and turned most of the night. The following morning, I said to myself that I'd soon find out if William Rainsford had a problem talking about his mother and her past. I was going to see him, after all. I was going to talk to him. In 2 days, Zoe and I were flying to Paris from JFK, then on to Florence. William Rainsford always spent his summer vacation in Lucca. Mara had told me that when she had given me his address. And Mara had phoned him to say I'd be looking him up. William Rainsford was aware that a Julia Jarmond was going to call him. That's all he knew. Tuscan heat had nothing to do with New England heat. It was overly dry, devoid of any humidity whatsoever. As I walked out of the Florence Peretola airport with Zoe in tow, the heat was so devastating, I thought I was going to shrivel up on the spot, dehydrated. I kept putting things down to my pregnancy, comforting myself, telling myself I didn't usually feel this drained, this parched. Jet lag didn't help either. The sun seemed to bite into me, to eat into my skin and eyes, despite a straw hat and dark glasses. I had rented a car, a modest-looking Fiat, which was waiting for us in the middle of a sun-drenched parking lot. The air conditioner was more than meek. As I backed out, I wondered suddenly if I was going to make the 40-minute drive to Lucca. I craved a cool, shady room, drifting to sleep in soft, light sheets. Zoe's stamina kept me going. She never stopped talking, pointed out the color of the sky, a deep, cloudless blue, the cypress trees lining the highway, the olive trees planted in little rows, the crumbling old houses glimpsed in the distance, perched on hilltops.
"Now that's Montecatini,"
she chirped knowingly, pointing and reading out from a guidebook.
"Famous for its luxury spa and its wine."
As I drove, Zoe read aloud about Lucca. It was one of the rare Tuscan towns to have kept its famous medieval walls circling an unspoiled center where few cars were allowed. "There was a lot to be seen," Zoe continued.
"The cathedral, the Church of San Michel, the Guinigui Tower, the Puccini Museum, the Palazzo Manzi."
I smiled at her, amused by her high spirits. She glanced back at me.
"I guess we don't have much time for sightseeing," she grinned. "We've got work to do, don't we, Mom?"
"We sure do," I agreed. Zoe had already found William Rainsford's address on her site map of Lucca. It wasn't far from the Via Filungo, the main artery of the town, a large pedestrian street, where I had booked rooms in a small guest house, Casa Giovanna. As we approached Lucca and its confusing maze of ring roads, I found I had to concentrate on the erratic driving methods of the cars surrounding me, which kept pulling out, stopping, or turning without any warning whatsoever. Definitely worse than Parisians, I decided, beginning to feel flustered and irritated. There was also a slow tug in the pit of my stomach that I did not like, that felt oddly like an oncoming period. Something I ate on the plane and that didn't agree with me? Or something worse? I felt apprehension flicker through me. Charla was right. It was crazy coming here in my condition, not even 3 months pregnant. It could have waited. William Rainsford could have waited another 6 months for my visit. But then I looked at Zoe's face. It was beautiful, incandescent with joy and excitement. She knew nothing yet about Bertrand and me separating. She was preserved still, innocent of all our plans. this would be a summer she would never forget. And as I drove the Fiat to one of the free parking lots near the city walls, I knew I wanted to make this part as wonderful as possible for her. I told Zoe I needed to put my feet up for a while. While she chatted away in the lobby with the amiable Giovanna, a buxom lady with a sultry voice, I had a cool shower and lay down on the bed. The ache in my lower abdomen slowly ebbed away. Our adjoining rooms were small, high up in the towering ancient building, but perfectly comfortable. I kept thinking of my mother's voice when I had called her from Charla's to say I wasn't coming to Nahant, that I was taking Zoe back to Europe. I could tell, from her brief pauses and the way she cleared her throat, that she was worried. She finally asked me if everything was all right. I replied cheerfully that everything was fine. I had an opportunity to visit Florence with Zoe. I would come back to the States later to see her and Dad.
"But you've barely arrived. And why leave when you've only been with Charla for a couple of days?" she protested. "And why interrupt Zoe's vacation here? I simply don't understand. And you were saying how much you missed the States. This is all so rushed."
I had felt guilty. But how could I explain the whole story to her and Dad over the phone? One day, I thought. Not now. I still felt guilty, lying on the pale pink bedspread that smelled faintly of lavender. I hadn't even told Mom about my pregnancy. I hadn't even told Zoe. I longed to let them in on the secret, and Dad as well. But something held me back. Some bizarre superstition, some deep-rooted apprehension I had never felt before. In the past few months, my life seemed to have shifted subtly. Was it to do with Sarah, with the Rue de Saint-Ange? Or was it just a belated coming of age? I could not tell. I only knew that I felt as if I had emerged from a long-lasting, mellow, protective fog. Now my senses were sharpened, keen. There was no fog. There was nothing mellow. There were only facts. Finding this man, telling him his mother had never been forgotten by the Tézac, by the Dufaux. I was impatient to see him. He was right here in this very town, maybe walking down the bustling Via Falungo now, at this precise moment. Somehow, as I lay in my little room, the sounds of voices and laughter rising from the narrow street through the open window, accompanied by the occasional roar of a Vespa or the sharp clang of a bicycle bell, I felt close to Sarah, closer than I had ever been before, because I was about to meet her son, her flesh, her blood. This was the closest I would ever get to the little girl with the yellow star. Just reach out your hand, pick up that phone, and call him. Simple. Easy. Yet I was incapable of doing it. I gazed at the obsolete black telephone, helpless, and sighed in despair and irritation. I lay back, feeling silly, almost ashamed. I realized I was so obsessed by Sarah's son that I hadn't even taken Luca in, its charm, its beauty. I had trudged through it like a sleepwalker, trailing behind Zoe, who seemed to glide along the intricacy of the old winding streets as if she had always lived here. I had seen nothing of Luca. Nothing mattered to me except William Rainsford, and I wasn't even capable of calling him. Zoe came in, sat on the edge of the bed.
"You all right?"
she asked. "I had a good rest," I answered. She scrutinized me, her hazel eyes roving over my face.
"I think you should rest a little longer, Mom."
I frowned. "Do I look that tired?" She nodded.
"Just rest, Mom. Giovanna gave me something to eat. You don't have to worry about me. Everything is under control."
I couldn't help smiling at her seriousness. When she got to the door, she turned around.
"Mom?"
"Yes, sweetheart?"
"Does Papa know we're here?"
I hadn't told Bertrand yet about bringing Zoe to Luca. No doubt he would explode when he found out.
"No, he doesn't, darling."
She fingered the door handle.
Did you and Papa have a fight?
No use lying to those clear, solemn eyes.
Yes, we did, honey. Papa doesn't agree with me trying to find out more about Sarah. He wouldn't be happy if he knew. Grandpère knows.
I sat up, startled. You spoke to your grandfather about all this? She nodded.
Yes. He really cares, you know, about Sarah. I called him from Long Island and told him you and I were coming here to meet her son. I knew you were going to call him at some point, but I was so excited I had to tell him.
And what did he say? I asked, amazed at my daughter's forthrightness.
He said we were right to come here. And he was going to tell Papa that, if ever Papa made a fuss. He said you were a wonderful person.
Edouard said that?
He did.
I shook my head, both baffled and touched.
Grandpère said something else. He said you had to take it easy. He said I had to make sure you didn't get too tired.
So Edouard knew. He knew I was pregnant. He had spoken to Bertrand. There had probably been a long talk between father and son, and Bertrand was now aware of everything that had happened in the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment in the summer of 1942. Zoe's voice dragged me away from Edouard.
Why don't you just call William, Mom? Make an appointment.
I sat up on the bed. You're right, honey. I took the slip of paper with William's number in Mara's handwriting and dialed it on the old-fashioned phone. My heart thumped away. This was surreal, I thought. Here I was, phoning Sarah's son. I heard a couple of irregular rings, then the whir of an answering machine, a woman's voice in rapid Italian. I hung up quickly, feeling foolish.
Now that was dumb, remarked Zoe. Never hang up on a machine. You told me that 1,000 times.
I redialed, smiling at her grown-up annoyance with me. This time I waited for the beep. And when I spoke, it all came out beautifully, like something I'd rehearsed for days. Good afternoon. This is Julia Jarmond. I'm calling on behalf of Mrs. Mara Rainsford. My daughter and I are in Lucca, staying at Casa Giovanna on the Via Falungo. We're here for a couple of days. Hope to hear from you. Thanks. Bye. I replaced the receiver in its black cradle, both relieved and disappointed.
Good, said Zoe. Now you go on with your rest. I'll see you later.
She planted a kiss on my forehead and left the room. We had dinner in a small, amusing restaurant behind the hotel, near the Amfiteatro, a large circle of ancient houses that used to host medieval games centuries ago. I felt restored after my rest and enjoyed the colorful parade of tourists, lucchesans, street vendors, children, pigeons. Italians love children, I discovered. Zoe was called Principessa by waiters, shopkeepers, fawned upon, beamed upon, her ears tweaked, her nose pinched, her hair stroked. It made me nervous at first, but she reveled in it, trying out her rudimentary Italian with ardor.
Sono francese e americana. Mi chiama Zoe.
The heat had abated, leaving cool drifts in its wake. However, I knew it would be hot and stuffy in our little rooms high above the street. Italians, like the French, weren't keen on air conditioning. I wouldn't have minded the icy blast of a machine tonight. When we got back to Casa Giovanna, dazed with jet lag, there was a note pinned on our door. Per favore telefonare William Rainsford. I stood thunderstruck. Zoe whooped. Now? I said.
Well, it's only 8:45,
Zoe said. Okay, I answered, opening the door with trembling fingers. The black receiver stuck to my ear. I dialed his number for the 3rd time that day. Answering machine, I mouthed to Zoe. Talk, she mouthed back. After the beep, I mumbled my name, hesitated, was about to hang up when a masculine voice said,
"Hello?"
An American accent. It was him.
"Hi," I said. "This is Julia Jarman."
"Hi," he said. "I'm in the middle of dinner."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"No problem. You want to meet up tomorrow before lunch?"
"Sure," I said.
"There's a nice cafe up on the walls, just beyond the Palazzo Manzi. We could meet there at noon?"
"Fine," I said. How do we find each other?" He laughed.
"Don't worry. Lucca is a tiny place. I'll find you."
A pause.
"Goodbye,"
he said, and hung up. The next morning, the pain was back in my stomach. Nothing powerful, but it bothered me with a discreet persistence. I decided to ignore it. If it was still there after lunch, I'd ask Giovanna for a doctor. As we walked to the cafe, I wondered how I was going to broach the subject with William. I had put off thinking about it, and I realized now that I shouldn't have. I was going to stir sad, painful memories. Maybe he did not want to talk about his mother at all. Maybe it was something he had put behind him. He had his life here, far from Roxbury, far from the Rue de Saint-Ange, a peaceful, bucolic life. And here I was, bringing back the past, the dead. Zoe and I discovered that one could actually walk on the thick medieval walls that circled the small city. They were high and wide, with a large path on their crest, hemmed in by a dense row of chestnut trees. We mingled with the incessant stream of joggers, walkers, cyclists, roller skaters, mothers with children, old men talking loudly, teenagers on scooters, tourists. The cafe was a little farther on, shaded by leafy trees. I drew nearer with Zoe, feeling strangely lightheaded, almost numb. The terrace was empty, save for a middle-aged couple having an ice cream and some German tourists poring over a map. I lowered my hat over my eyes, smoothed out my crumpled skirt. When he said my name, I was busy reading the menu to Zoe.
"Julia Jarmond."
I looked up to a tall, thick-set man in his mid-40s. He sat down opposite Zoe and me.
"Hi,"
said Zoe. I found I could not speak. I could only stare at him. His hair was dark blonde, swept with gray, receding hairline, square jaw, a beautiful beak of a nose.
"Hi," he said to Zoe. "Have the tiramisu. You'll love it."
Then he lifted his dark glasses, gliding them back over his forehead to rest on top of his skull. His mother's eyes, turquoise and slanted. He smiled.
"So you're a journalist, I gather. Based in Paris? Looked you up on the internet."
I coughed, fingering my watch nervously. "I looked you up as well, you know. That was a fabulous book, your last one, Tuscan Feasts." William Rainsford sighed and patted his stomach.
"Ah, that book contributed nicely to an extra 10 pounds I've never been able to get rid of."
I smiled brightly. It was going to be difficult to switch from this pleasant, easy conversation to what I knew lay ahead. Zoe looked at me purposefully. "It's very nice of you to come here and meet us. I appreciate it." My voice sounded lame, lost.
"No problem,"
he grinned, clicking his fingers at the waiter. We ordered tiramisu and a Coke for Zoe, and 2 cappuccinos.
"Your first time in Lucca?"
he asked. I nodded. The waiter hovered over us. William Rainsford spoke to him in rapid, smooth Italian. They both laughed.
"I come to this cafe often," he explained. "I like hanging out here, even on a hot day like this."
Zoe tried out her tiramisu, her spoon clicking against the small glass bowl. A sudden silence fell upon us.
"What can I do to help?"
he asked brightly.
"Mara mentioned something about my mother."
I praised Mara inwardly. She had made things easier, it seemed.
I didn't know your mother had passed away, I said. I'm sorry.
That's all right, he shrugged, dropping a lump of sugar into his coffee. Happened a long time ago. I was a kid. Did you know her? You look a little young for that.
I shook my head. No, I never met your mother. I happened to be moving into the apartment she lived in during the war, Rue de Saint-Ange in Paris, and I know people who were close to her. That's why I'm here. That's why I came to see you.
He put his coffee cup down and looked at me quietly. The clear eyes were reflective, calm. Under the table, Zoe placed a sticky hand on my bare knee. I watched a couple of cyclists wheel past. The heat was pounding down on us again. I took a deep breath.
I'm not quite sure how to begin, I faltered. And I know it must be difficult for you to have to think about this again, but I felt I had to. My in-laws, the Tézac, met your mother in the Rue de Saint-Ange in 1942.
I thought the name Tézac might ring a bell, but he remained motionless. Rue de Saint-Ange did not seem to either. After what happened, I mean the tragic events of July 42, and the death of your uncle, I just wanted to assure you that the Tézac family has never been able to forget your mother. My father-in-law especially thinks of her every day. There was a silence. William Rainsford's eyes seemed to shrink.
I'm sorry, I said quickly. I knew all this would be painful for you. I'm sorry.
When he finally spoke, his voice sounded odd, almost smothered. What do you mean by tragic events?
Well, the Veldiv roundup, I stammered. Jewish families rounded up in Paris in July 42.
Go on, he said.
And the camps, the families sent to Auschwitz from Drancy.
William Rainsford spread his palms wide, shook his head. I'm sorry, but I don't see what this has to do with my mother. Zoe and I exchanged uneasy glances. A long minute dragged by. I felt acutely uncomfortable.
You mentioned the death of an uncle, he said at last.
Yes, Michel, your mother's little brother, in the Rue de Saint-Ange.
Silence.
Michel?
He seemed puzzled.
My mother never had a brother called Michel, and I've never heard of the Rue de Saint-Ange. You know, I don't think we're talking about the same person.
But your mother's name was Sarah, right?
I mumbled, confused. He nodded.
Yes, that's right. Sarah Dufour.
Yes, Sarah Dufour, that's her, I said eagerly. Or rather, Sarah Starzinski.
I expected his eyes to light up.
Excuse me, he said,
eyebrows slanting downward.
Sarah what?
Starzinski, your mother's maiden name.
William Rainsford stared at me, lifting his chin.
My mother's maiden name was Dufour.
A warning bell went off in my head. Something was wrong. He did not know. There was still time to leave. Time to take off before I shattered the peace in this man's life to pieces. I pasted a blithe smile on my face, murmured something about a mistake, and scraped my chair back a couple of inches, gently urging Zoe to leave her dessert. I wouldn't be wasting his time any longer. I was most sorry. I rose from my seat. He did as well.
I think you've got the wrong Sarah, he said, smiling. It doesn't matter. Enjoy your stay in Lucca. It was nice meeting you, anyway.
Before I could utter a word, Zoe put her hand into my bag and handed him something. William Rainsford looked down at the photograph of the little girl with the yellow star.
Is this your mother?
Zoe asked with a small voice. It seemed that everything had gone quiet around us. No noise came from the busy path. Even the birds seemed to have stopped chirping. There was only the heat and silence.
Jesus,
he said. And then he sat down again, heavily. The photograph lay flat between us on the table. William Rainsford looked from it to me, again and again. He read the caption on the back several times, with an incredulous, startled expression.
"This looks exactly like my mother as a child," he said, finally. "That I can't deny."
Zoe and I remained silent.
"I don't understand. This can't be. This is not possible."
He rubbed his hands together nervously. I noticed he wore a silver wedding band. He had long, slim fingers.
"The star,"
he kept shaking his head.
"That star on her chest."
Was it possible this man did not know the truth about his mother's past? Her religion? Was it possible that Sarah had not ever told the Rainsfords? As I watched his puzzled face, his anxiety, I felt I knew. No, she had not told them. She had not revealed her childhood, her origins, her religion. She had made a clean break with her terrible past. I wanted to be far away, far from this town, this country, this man's incomprehension. How could I have been so blind? How could I have not seen this coming? Not once had I ever thought that Sarah could have kept all this secret. Her suffering had been too great. That was why she had never written to the Dufaux. That was why she had never told her son about who she really was. In America, she had wanted to start a new life. And here I was, a stranger, revealing the stark truth to this man, a clumsy bearer of ill tidings. William Rainsford pushed the photograph back toward me, his mouth taut.
"What have you come here for?"
he whispered. My throat felt dry.
"To tell me my mother was called something else? That she was involved in a tragedy? Is that why you are here?"
I could sense my legs trembling under the table. This was not what I had imagined. I had imagined pain, sorrow, but not this, not his anger. "I thought you knew," I ventured. "I came because my family remembers what she went through, back in 42. That's why I'm here." He shook his head again, raked agitated fingers through his hair. His dark glasses clattered to the table.
"No,"
he breathed.
"No. No, no, this is crazy. My mother was French. She was called Dufaux. She was born in Orléans. She lost her parents during the war. She had no brothers. She had no family. She never lived in Paris in that Rue de Saint-Ange. This little Jewish girl cannot be her. You've got this all wrong."
"Please," I said gently, "let me explain. Let me tell you the whole story." He pushed his palms up to me, as if he meant to shove me away.
"I don't want to know. Keep the whole story to yourself."
I felt the familiar ache tug at my insides, plucking at my womb with a deft gnaw.
"Please," I said feebly. "Please listen to me."
William Rainsford was on his feet, a quick, supple gesture for such a big man. He looked down at me, his face dark.
"I'm going to be very clear. I don't want to see you again. I don't want to talk about this again. Please don't call me."
And he was gone. Zoe and I stared after him. All this for nothing. This whole trip, all these efforts for this dead end. I could not believe Sarah's story could end here so quickly. It could not just dry out. We sat in silence for a long moment. Then, shivering despite the heat, I paid the bill. Zoe did not say a word. She seemed stunned. I got up, weariness hindering every move. What now? Where to go? Back to Paris? Back to Charlotte's? I trudged on, my feet as heavy as lead. I could hear Zoe's voice calling out to me, but I did not want to turn around. I wanted to get back to the hotel fast, to think, to get going, to call my sister, and Edouard, and Gaspard. Zoe's voice was loud now, anxious. What did she want? Why was she whining? I noticed passers-by staring at me. I swiveled around to my daughter, exasperated, telling her to hurry up. She rushed to my side, grabbed my hand. Her face was pale.
"Mom!"
she whispered, her voice strained thin.
"What? What is it?"
I snapped. She pointed at my legs. She started to whimper, like a puppy. I glanced down. My white skirt was soaked with blood. I looked back to my seat, imprinted with a crimson half-moon. Thick red rivulets trickled down my thighs.
"Are you hurt, Mom?"
choked Zoe. I clutched my stomach.
"The baby!"
I said, aghast. Zoe stared at me.
"The baby!"
she screamed, her fingers biting into my arm.
"Mom, what baby? What are you talking about?"
Her pointed face loomed away from me. My legs buckled. I landed chin first on the hot, dry path. Then silence and darkness. I opened my eyes to Zoe's face, a few inches from mine. I could smell the unmistakable scent of a hospital around me. A small green room, an IV in my forearm, a woman wearing a white blouse scribbling something on a chart.
"Mom," whispered Zoe, squeezing my hand. "Mom, everything is okay. Don't worry."
The young woman came to my side, smiled, and patted Zoe's head.
"You will be all right, signora," she said,
in surprisingly good English.
"You lost blood, a lot, but you are fine now."
My voice came out like a groan.
"And the baby?"
"The baby is fine. We did a scan. There was problem with placenta. You need to rest now. No getting up for a while."
She left the room, closing the door quietly behind her.
"You scared the shit out of me," said Zoe. "And I can say shit today. I don't think you'll scold me."
I pulled her close, hugging her as hard as I could despite the IV.
"Mom, why didn't you tell me about the baby?"
"I was going to, sweetie." She looked up at me.
"Is the baby why you and Papa are having problems?"
"Yes."
"You want the baby and Papa doesn't, right?"
"Something like that." She stroked my hand gently.
"Papa is on his way."
"Oh, God," I said. "Bertrand here. Bertrand in the aftermath of all this."
"I phoned him," said Zoe. "He'll be here in a couple of hours."
Tears welled up in my eyes, slowly trickled down my cheeks.
"Mom, don't cry,"
pleaded Zoe, frantically wiping my face with her hands.
"It's okay. Everything is okay now."
I smiled wearily, nodding my head to reassure her, but my world felt hollow, empty. I kept thinking of William Rainsford walking away.
"I don't want to see you again. I don't want to talk about this again. Please don't call me."
His shoulders, rounded, stooped, the tightness of his mouth. The days, weeks, months to come stretched ahead, bleak and gray. Never had I felt so despondent, so lost. The core of me had been nibbled away. What was left for me? A baby my soon-to-be ex-husband did not want and that I'd have to raise on my own. A daughter who would shortly become a teenager and who might no longer remain the marvelous little girl she was now. What was there to look forward to all of a sudden? Bertrand arrived. Calm, efficient, tender. I put myself in his hands, listened to him talking to the doctor, watching him reassure Zoe with an occasional warm glance. He took care of all the details. I was to stay here till the bleeding stopped completely,
Then I was to fly back to Paris and take it easy until fall, till my 5th month. Bertrand did not mention Sarah once. He did not ask a single question. I retreated into a comfortable silence. I did not want to talk about Sarah. I began to feel like a little old lady, shipped here and there, like Mamet was shipped here and there, within the familiar boundaries of her home, receiving the same placid smiles, the same stale benevolence. It was easy letting someone else control your life. I had nothing much to fight for anyway, except this child. The child that Bertrand did not once mention either. When we landed in Paris a few weeks later, it felt like an entire year had gone by. I still felt tired and sad. I thought of William Rainsford every day. Several times I reached out for the phone, or pen and paper, meaning to talk to him, to write, to explain, to say something, to say sorry, but I never dared. I let the days slip by, the summer move into fall. I lay on my bed and read, wrote my articles on my laptop, spoke to Joshua, Bamber, Alessandra, to my family and friends on the telephone. I worked from my bedroom. It had all seemed complicated at first, but it had worked out. My friends, Isabelle, Holly, and Susanna, took turns coming and making me lunch. Once a week, one of my sisters-in-law would go to the nearby Eno or Franprix for groceries with Zoe. Plump, sensual Cécile would make fluffy crepes oozing with butter, and aesthetic angular Laure would create exotic, low-calorie salads that were surprisingly savory. My mother-in-law came less often, but sent her cleaning lady, the dynamic and odorous Madame Leclerc, who vacuumed with such terrifying energy it gave me contractions. My parents came to stay for a week in their favorite little hotel on the Rue de l'Ombre, ecstatic at the idea of becoming grandparents again. Edouard came to visit every Friday with a bouquet of pink roses. He would sit in the armchair next to the bed, and again he would ask me to describe the conversation that took place between William and me and Luca. He would shake his head and sigh. He said over and over that he should have anticipated William's reaction. How was it that neither himself nor I could possibly have imagined that William never knew, that Sarah had never breathed a word?
"Can we not call him?"
he would say, his eyes hopeful.
"Can I not telephone him and explain?"
Then he would look at me and mumble,
"No, of course I can't do that. How stupid of me. How ridiculous of me."
I asked my doctor if I could host a small gathering, lying down on my living room sofa. She accepted and made me promise not to carry anything heavy and to remain horizontal, à la Récamier. One evening in late summer, Gaspard and Nicolas Dufour came to meet Edouard. Nathalie Dufour was there as well. And I had invited Guillaume. It was a moving, magical moment. 3 elderly men who had an unforgettable little girl in common. I watched them pore over the old photos of Sarah, the letters. Gaspard and Nicolas asked us about William. Nathalie listened, helping Zoe pass around drinks and food. Nicolas, a slightly younger version of Gaspard with the same round face and wispy white hair, spoke of his particular relationship with Sarah, how he used to tease her because her silence pained him so, and how any reaction, albeit a shrug, an insult, or a kick, was a triumph because she had for one instant emerged from her secrecy, her isolation. He told us about the first time she had bathed in the sea at Trouville, in the beginning of the 50s. She had stared out at the ocean in absolute wonder, and then she had stretched out her arms, whooped with delight, and rushed to the water on her nimble, skinny legs, and dashed into the cool blue waves with screeches of joy. And they had followed her, hollering just as loud, entranced by a new Sarah they had never seen.
"She was beautiful," Nicolas recalled. A beautiful 18-year-old, glowing with life and energy. And I felt that day for the first time that there was happiness within her, that there was hope for her ahead.
2 years later, I thought, Sarah was out of the Dufault lives forever, carrying her secret past to America. And 20 years later, she was dead. What had those 20 years in America been like, I mused. Her marriage, the birth of her son. Had she been happy in Roxbury? Only William had those answers, I thought. Only William could tell us. My eyes met Edouard's, and I could tell he was thinking the same thing. I heard Bertrand's key in the lock, and my husband appeared, tanned, handsome, exuding habit rouge, smiling breezily, shaking hands smoothly, and I couldn't help remembering the lyrics of that Carly Simon song that reminded Charla of Bertrand. You walked in to the party like you were walking onto a yacht. Bertrand had decided to postpone the move to the Rue de Saint-Ange because of the problems with my pregnancy. In this odd new life I still could not get used to, he was physically present in a friendly, useful way, but not there spiritually. He traveled more than usual, came home late, left early. We still shared a bed, but it was no longer a marital bed. The Berlin Wall had sprouted in its middle. Zoe seemed to take all this in her stride. She often talked about the baby, how much it meant to her, how excited she was. She had been shopping with my mother during my parents' stay, and they had gone crazy at Bonpoint, the outrageously expensive and exquisite baby wear boutique on the Rue de l'Université. Most people reacted like my daughter, my parents, and sister, and my in-laws, and Mamay. They were thrilled by the upcoming birth. Even Joshua, infamous for his scorn toward babies and sick leaves, seemed interested.
I didn't know one could have kids at middle age, he had said snidely.
No one ever mentioned the crisis my marriage was going through. No one seemed to notice it. Did they all secretly believe that Bertrand, once the child was born, would come to his senses? That he would welcome this child with open arms? I realized that both Bertrand and I had locked each other into a state of numbness, of not talking, of not telling. We were both waiting for the baby to be born. Then we'd see. Then we'd have to move on. Then decisions would have to be made. One morning, I felt the baby start to move deep within me, to give those first tiny kicks one mistakes for gas. I wanted the baby out of me, into my arms. I hated this state of silent lethargy, this waiting. I felt trapped. I wanted to zoom to winter, to early next year, to the birth. I hated the end of summer that lingered on, the fading heat, the dust, the stealthy minutes that oozed by with the laziness of molasses. I hated the French word for the beginning of September, back to school, and the new start after summer. La rentrée, repeated over and over again on the radio, on television, in the newspapers. I hated people asking me what the baby was going to be called. The amniocentesis had revealed its sex, but I had not wanted to be told. The baby did not have a name yet, which did not mean I wasn't ready for it. I crossed out every day on my calendar. September merged into October. My stomach rounded out nicely. I could get up now, go back to the office, pick Zoe up at school, go to the movies with Isabelle, meet Guillaume at the Select for lunch. But although my days felt fuller, busier, the emptiness and the ache remained. William Rainsford, his face, his eyes, his expression when he had looked down at the little girl with the star. Jesus. His voice when he had said that. What was his life like now? Had he erased everything from his mind the moment he turned his back on Zoe and me? Had he already forgotten once he had reached home? Or was it different? Was it hell for him because he could not stop thinking about what I had said? Because my revelations had changed his entire life. His mother had become a stranger, somebody with a past he knew nothing about. I wondered whether he had said anything to his wife, his daughters. Anything about an American woman turning up in Lucca with a kid, showing him a photo, telling him his mother was a Jew, that she had been rounded up during the war, that she had suffered, lost a brother, parents he'd never heard of. I wondered if he had researched information concerning the Veldiv, if he had read articles, books about what took place in July 1942 in the heart of Paris. I wondered if he lay awake in bed at night and thought of his mother, of her past, of the truth of it, of what remained secret, unspoken, shrouded in darkness. The Rue de Saint-Ange apartment was nearly ready. Bertrand had arranged for Zoe and me to move in just after the baby's birth in February. It looked beautiful, different. His team had done a wonderful job. It no longer bore Mamet's imprint, and I imagined it was a far cry from what Sarah had known. But as I wandered through the freshly painted, empty rooms, the new kitchen, my private office, I asked myself if I could bear living here, living where Sarah's little brother had died. The secret cupboard did not exist anymore. It had been destroyed when two rooms had been made into one. But somehow that changed nothing for me. This is where it had happened, and I could not erase that from my mind. I had not told my daughter about the tragedy that had taken place here, but she sensed it in her particular emotional way. On a damp November morning, I went to the apartment to start working on curtains, wallpaper, carpeting. Isabelle had been particularly helpful and had escorted me around shops and department stores. To Zoe's delight, I had decided to ignore the quiet, placid tones I had resorted to in the past and make a wild go at new, bold colors. Bertrand had waved a careless hand.
"You and Zoe make the decisions. It's your home, after all."
Zoe had decided on lime green and pale purple for her bedroom. It was so reminiscent of Charlotte's taste that I had to smile. A cluster of catalogs awaited me on the bare, polished floorboards. I was leafing through them studiously when my cell phone rang. I recognized the number, Mamet's nursing home. Mamet had been tired lately, irritable, sometimes unbearable. It was difficult to make her smile. Even Zoe had a hard time doing so. She was impatient with everybody. Going to see her recently had almost become a chore.
"Miss Jamal, this is Véronique at the nursing home. I'm afraid I don't have good news. Madame Tézac is not well. She has had a stroke."
I sat up, shock reeling through me. "A stroke?"
"She is a bit better, with Dr. Roche now, but you must come. We have reached your father-in-law, but we cannot get hold of your husband."
I hung up feeling flustered, panicky. Outside, I heard rain pattering against the window panes. Where was Bertrand? I dialed his number and got his voicemail. At his office, near the Madeleine, nobody seemed to know where he was, not even Antoine. I told Antoine I was at the Rue de Saint-Ange, and could he have Bertrand call me ASAP? I said it was very urgent.
"Mon Dieu, the baby?"
he stammered. "No, Antoine, not the bébé, the grand-mère," I replied, and hung up. I glanced outside. The rain was falling thickly now, a gray, glistening curtain. I'd get wet. Too bad, I thought. Who cared? Mamet. Wonderful, darling Mamet. My Mamet. No, Mamet could not possibly go now. I needed her. This was too soon. I was unprepared. But how could I ever be prepared for her death, I thought. I looked around me, at the living room, remembering that this had been the very place where I had met her for the first time. And once again, I felt overwhelmed by the weight of all the events that had taken place here.
and that seemed to be coming back to haunt me. I decided to call Cécile and Laure to make sure they knew and were on their way. Laure sounded businesslike and curt. She was already in her car. She'd see me there, she said. Cécile appeared more emotional, fragile, a hint of tears in her voice.
Oh, Julia, I can't bear the idea of my you know, it's too awful.
I told her I couldn't get hold of Bertrand. She sounded surprised.
But I just spoke to him, she said.
Did you reach him on his cell phone?
No,
she replied, her voice hesitant. At the office, then?
He's coming to pick me up any minute. He's taking me to the nursing home.
I wasn't able to contact him.
Oh?
She said carefully.
I see.
Then I got it. I felt anger surge through me.
He was at Amélie's, right? Amélie's?
She repeated blandly. I stamped impatiently. Oh, come on, Cécile, you know exactly who I'm talking about.
The buzzer's going, that's Bertrand,
she breathed, rushed. And she hung up. I stood in the middle of the empty room, cell phone clenched in my hand like a weapon. I pressed my forehead against the coolness of the window pane. I wanted to hit Bertrand. It was no longer his never-ending affair with Amélie that got to me. It was the fact that his sisters had that woman's number and knew where to reach him in case of an emergency like this one, and I did not. It was the fact that even if our marriage was dying, he still did not have the courage to tell me he was still seeing this woman. As usual, I was the last to know. The eternal, vaudevillesque, wronged spouse. I stood there for a long time, motionless, feeling the baby kick within me. I did not know whether to laugh or to cry. Did I still care for Bertrand? Was this why it still hurt? Or was it just a question of wounded pride? Amélie and her Parisian glamour and perfection, her daringly modern apartment overlooking the Trocadéro, her well-mannered children,
Bonjour, madame,
and her powerful perfume that lingered in Bertrand's hair and his clothes. If he loved her, and no longer me, why was he afraid of telling me? Was he afraid of hurting me? Hurting Zoe? What made him so frightened? When would he realize that it wasn't his infidelity I couldn't bear, but his cowardice? I went to the kitchen. My mouth felt parched. I turned on the tap and drank directly from the faucet, my cumbersome belly brushing against the sink. I peered out again. The rain seemed to have abated. I slipped on my raincoat, grabbed my purse, and headed to the door. Somebody knocked. 3 short blows. Bertrand, I thought, grimly. Antoine or Cécile had probably told him to call or come. I imagined Cécile waiting in the car below, her embarrassment, the nervous, tight silence that would ensue as soon as I would get into the Audi. Well, I'd show them. I'd tell them. I wasn't going to play timid, nice French wife. I was going to ask Bertrand to tell me the truth from now on. I flung the door open. But the man waiting for me on the threshold was not Bertrand. I recognized the height, the broad shoulders immediately. Ash-blonde hair darkened by the rain, plastered back over his skull. William Rainsford. I stepped back, startled.
Is this a bad moment?
He said. No, I managed. What on earth was he doing here? What did he want? We stared at each other. Something in his face had changed since the last time I'd seen him. He seemed gaunt, haunted, no longer the easygoing gourmet with a tan.
I need to talk to you, he said. It's urgent. I'm sorry I couldn't find your number, so I came here. You weren't in last night, so I thought I'd come back this morning.
How did you get this address? I asked, confused. It's not listed yet. We haven't moved in yet. He took an envelope out of the pocket of his jacket.
The address was in here. The same street you mentioned in Lucca, Rue de Saint-Ange.
I shook my head. I don't get it. He handed the envelope to me. It was old, torn at the corners. There was nothing written on it.
Open it,
he said. I pulled out a slim, tattered notebook, a faded drawing, and a long brass key that fell to the floor with a clank. He bent to pick it up, nestling it in the palm of his hand for me to see.
What is all this?
I asked warily.
When you left Lucca, I was in a state of shock. I could not get that photograph out of my mind. I could not stop thinking about it.
Yes, I said, my heart beating fast.
I flew to Roxbury to see my dad. He's very ill, as I think you know, dying of cancer. He can't speak anymore. I looked around. I found this envelope in his desk. He had kept it after all these years. He had never shown it to me.
Why are you here?
I whispered. There was pain in his eyes, pain and fear.
Because I need you to tell me what happened. What happened to my mother as a child. I need to know everything. You're the only person who can help me.
I looked down at the key in his hand. Then I glanced at the drawing. An awkward sketch of a little boy with fair, curly hair. He seemed to be sitting in a small cupboard, with a book on his knee, and a toy bear next to him. On the back, a faded scrawl, Michel, 26, Rue de Saint-Ange. I leafed through the notebook. No dates. Short sentences scribbled like a poem. In French. Difficult to make out. A few words jumped out at me. Le camp, la clé, ne jamais oublier, mourir. Did you read this? I asked.
I tried. My French is bad. I can only understand parts of it.
The phone in my pocket rang, startling us. I fumbled for it. It was Edouard.
Where are you, Julia? He asked gently. She's not well. She wants you.
I'm coming, I replied.
William Rainsford looked down at me.
You have to go?
Yes, a family emergency. My husband's grandmother. She's had a stroke.
I'm sorry.
He hesitated, then put a hand on my shoulder.
When can I see you? Talk to you?
I opened the front door, turned back to him, looked down at his hand on my shoulder. It was strange, moving, to see him on the threshold of that apartment, the very place that had caused his mother so much pain, so much sorrow, and to think he did not yet know. He did not yet know what had happened here, to his family, his grandparents, his uncle.
You're coming with me, I said. There's someone I want you to meet.
Mamie's tired, withered face. She seemed asleep. I spoke to her, but I wasn't sure she heard me. Then I felt her fingers encircle my wrist. She held on tight. She knew I was there. Behind me, the Tézac family stood around the bed. Bertrand, his mother Colette, Edouard, Laure and Cécile. And behind them, hesitating in the hall, stood William Rainsford. Bertrand had glanced at him once or twice, puzzled. He probably thought he was my new boyfriend. At any other time than this, I would have laughed. Edouard had looked at him several times, curious, eyes screwed up, then back at me with insistence. It was later, when we were filing out of the nursing home, that I took my father-in-law's arm. We had just been told by Dr. Roche that Mamie's condition had stabilized, but she was weak. There was no telling what would happen next. We had to prepare ourselves, he said. We had to convince each other this was probably the end. I'm so sad and sorry, Edouard, I murmured. He stroked my cheek.
My mother loves you, Julia. She loves you dearly.
Bertrand appeared, his face glum. I glanced at him, briefly thinking of Amélie, toying with the idea of saying something that would hurt, that would sting, and finally letting go. After all, there would be time ahead to discuss it. It did not matter right now. Only Mamet mattered now, and the tall silhouette waiting for me in the hall.
"Julia," said Edouard, looking back over his shoulder. "Who is that man?"
"Sarah's son." Awed, Edouard gazed at the tall figure for a couple of minutes.
"Did you phone him?"
"No. He recently discovered some papers that his father had hidden all this time. Something Sarah wrote. He's here because he wants to know the whole story. He came today."
"I would like to speak to him," said Edouard.
I went to fetch William. I told him my father-in-law wanted to meet him. He followed me, dwarfing Bertrand and Edouard, Colette, her daughters. Edouard Tézac looked up at him. His face was calm, composed, but there was a wetness in his eyes. He held out his hand. William took it. It was a powerful, silent moment. No one spoke.
"Sarah Stalzinski's son,"
murmured Edouard. I shot a glance at Colette, Cécile, and Laure.